Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Ettore Leale, Program Chair of the Club Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Einar Enevoldsson. Einar Enevoldsson served as a fighter pilot in the United States Air Force and as an exchange officer with the United Kingdom's Royal Air Force. From 1968 through 1988, Einar was research pilot at NASA's Dryden Flight Research Center at Edwards, California, where he flew dozens of pioneering aircraft, including the interceptor version of the SR-71 Blackbird, the world's fastest airplane. He received the Distinguished Flying Cross from the United States Air Force, and he was twice awarded the Exceptional Service Medal from NASA. Einar has flown above 50,000 feet in over 14 different types of aircraft, and he held several time-to-climb and altitude world records. In 1992, Einar first envisioned the Perlman Project with the ambition to leverage stratospheric mountain waves to fly a glider to astonishing heights. Einar and Steve Fawcett proved this concept when in August 2006, they set a world record altitude for gliders or 50,000 feet over Patagonia. Einar first introduced the Perlman Project at the Commonwealth Club of California in April 2009, and tonight Einar will share with us an update on his pioneering work. Without further ado, please join me in welcoming Einar Enevoldsson.
Well, thank you. This story has several parts that sort of fit together, so don't give up. Hope that it'll make sense by the time we get through. We're going to start out with explaining some basic ideas, the polar vortex, mountain waves, talk about the high-altitude flight, the proof-of-concept flight, the new airplane, and our feeling that we have something to offer high school age and maybe junior high school age students. So we'll start out with this is really the beginning of the project right here. In around 1992, there was a German scientist that obtained this false color image. He'd been working for, he said, 50 years to get this image. And right around 1992, he got it. And I just happened to be walking down the hall by chance in his building in South Germany. And he was tacking up this picture, and he was so proud of it. So I saw it almost as soon as it happened. And what it shows is the undulation of the wind. The wind is coming along from here, and it's undulating with a wavelength of on the order of 15 or 20 kilometers. And it's up here at around 23 kilometers high, and it's which is about 75,000 feet. So I saw that and I thought, wow, I think I could surf with a sailplane on this rising surface. And so since 1992, that's been my principal interest in life, is surfing on that surface. The first step in all this is try to understand why is that wave there. That wave was over northern Scandinavia. And what I found fairly soon was that what enables that is a thing called the polar vortex. I'm going to show you an animation of the polar vortex from a season of NASA data that takes about 2.5 months to run through. And here's Iceland, here's Greenland, here's Scandinavia, Spitsbergen. So the North Pole is about here somewhere. So I'll run this animation, and we'll see a rope of wind that's kind of wobbly like jelly, and it wanders back and forth and changes shape over a season. I'll run it one more time. And that rope of wind is centered about 100,000 feet high, and it's moving about double the speed of the average of a typical jet stream that you're familiar with. This gives a little better idea. Now, that polar vortex exists at the winter end of the Earth, and it starts in midwinter and runs through early or mid-spring. The northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere are not the same. You can see the northern hemisphere was pretty tight around the pole. In the southern hemisphere, it comes clear out here to about 50 degrees south. And this, what this shows is here's the South Pole, and here's the equator, and this is sea level, and this is 100,000 feet, and the colors depict the winds. So this shows the strong wind band at 50 degrees south. This happens to be a cross-section at 72 degrees west. But you could take a cross-section anywhere, any latitude, any longitude, and you'd see something similar. It might be a little different latitude and a little different strength and so on. So that's the that's a little more detail. And this is not a particularly strong polar vortex on the order of 140 or 150 knots. So it's not a super strong one. We'll go into that a little bit more later. This is the general scheme of, I was going to say that the whole thing is called the polar vortex, and that outer rope, to be strictly technically accurate, is called the stratospheric polar night jet. And if you're interested, you can Google polar vortex, and you can Google stratospheric polar night jet, and you'll learn more than you can understand about those phenomena. And what drives this whole thing is this is the winter end of the Earth, north or south, and it's in the end of the Earth is in shadow, and the stratosphere is cooling, and what drives it is the subsidence due to the cooling and kind of a coordinating down of the stratosphere. And it's radiating to space, and it's not getting any sun in, so it just cools a lot. Now, the ozone hole comes into the picture because the ozone hole results in greater cooling. The stratosphere gets colder because of the existence of the ozone hole. And that's a new thing. Here's from 1970 to 1980, we see actually no ozone hole. The red is kind of an abundance of ozone, and the greenish is kind of normal ozone. And here's 2006 to 2009, and you've got a big hole of deficiency of ozone. This turns out this area is about the size of the United States, and that's where ozone is depleted. And that causes greater chilling, and so that actually makes, since 1980-ish, the polar vortex has been stronger, bigger, and the wind has been stronger. And this gives a little idea of what's been happening. Here's 1980 to 2010, and this is the size of the polar of the ozone hole, and this is once again roughly the size of the United States up here. So it, in around 1980, it really started getting bigger fast, and it stayed relatively steady since that time. And this is the degree of depletion. And the depletion wasn't much, and then it reached its maximum, and it's stayed fairly constant since roughly 1990. So in 1992, this thing had really finally developed pretty much fully. And the outlook for it, as best you can guess, is that it's going to gradually diminish probably over the next 50 years. And that depends a lot on how much bootleg refrigerant of the dangerous kind is released into the atmosphere. If no additional ozone-destroying chemicals are released into the atmosphere, it'll probably gradually diminish, depending, and it could stay constant or it could increase. The next thing that affects the, this is nothing, that's just a blank. The next thing that comes into play is warming of the polar regions. It turns out when the low altitude and the surface of the polar regions are warmed, the stratosphere in the polar regions chills. So once again, there's been a lot of warming in the polar regions, and the stratosphere has got a lot colder, so that that is in addition to the ozone hole. So both effects have increased the strength and the persistence of the polar vortex and the night jet. That's all new stuff. Thank you. I was just reading a recent kind of a summary paper. There's all over the world, there's several major organizations and universities that are doing climate modeling. The summary paper is kind of looking at points of agreement and things that they also agree that they'd like to understand better. And their points of agreement certainly are that when the poles warm at low altitude, they get cold at high altitude. That's an agreement. A point where they think, not disagreement, but where they'd like to understand better is mixing at the boundary of the polar vortex, where the air within the polar vortex, it gets exchange of momentum, energy, and mass with air outside the polar vortex, and also mixing between layers of the stratosphere. Normally, the stratosphere doesn't mix. It's really dormant, and there are very few mechanisms. Molecular diffusion takes years for things to mix, and so you have to have some kind of turbulence, and there isn't much turbulence in general in the stratosphere. But this is one place that there is, and we'll get to that. So we'll move on to the next thing, which is talking about mountain waves. Now, most of the people in here know mountain waves as well as I do, but for those that don't, I'll do a quick. This is a lousy schematic that I got off the web. But say, first of all, we got a wind which is increasing with altitude over here. That's blowing. And we're blowing, wind is typically out of the west. We've got some kind of hills. We got a downhill slope. It doesn't matter much what happens over here, no matter what happens. This air goes downhill, and when the wind profile is right, when the temperature profile distribution is right, the wind bounces, and it's resonant. And the atmosphere is just a big resonant bowl of jelly, and it'll wobble at all kinds of different wavelengths and frequencies. And one of them that happens a lot is standing mountain waves. And this stuff is sort of coincidental, this terrain here. This standing mountain wave is a consequence of this downslope, and there may be a train of these things. It'll continue bouncing, or it may just do once and damp. It may go up a little ways and stop, or it may go right on up. This would be the tropopause here and the stratosphere above. And typically, waves go to the tropopause, and they don't extend above it, because typically there's no wind above it. But as you saw in that previous slide, underneath the stratospheric polar night jet, there is a wind above it. So the waves do have the potential to continue upward. And this is just a picture of a pretty mountain wave. I think that's Mount Shasta. And it's very impressive looking and spooky. And you think, oh, my goodness, it's going to eat me or something. And, in fact, it's very benign. It doesn't do anything. There could be some supercooled water in that. And if you fly it through it for a long time, it could freeze and give you some ice. And here's some funny little clouds that don't look like much. And that's where you'll get a dollar's worth of turbulence. And you'll get a fine ride in that. But this big, impressive-looking thing is quite friendly. Except it has a big updraft in front of it and a big downdraft behind it. And for any of you that are not familiar with those clouds, those lenticular clouds, there's maybe 100 knot wind blowing across here, and the cloud doesn't move. It stays stationary. And it's continuously forming on the front edge and continuously dissipating on the back edge. It forms because the air, cold, like all clouds, the air is going up and it chills, and it reaches the dew point, and on the backside, the air is coming down, it warms up, and the water evaporates. Gliders have been used to explore waves, well, really from the beginning almost, in Germany in 1935. But here was like in California, in the down south of Bishop, or in Bishop, in 1947, Paul McCready, that some of you know, are familiar with, flew to 29,000, and John Robinson flew to 33,000 in their wooden gliders, iron men and wooden ships. And they learned a lot about, and it caused quite a stir in the aeronautical community that this was happening. So the question that's always intrigued some of us, these are nacreous or mother of pearl clouds, and pearlan is an old Norse word for pearl. So these are sort of pearlescent clouds, and they are seen in near the Arctic Circle, primarily in Scandinavia and Finland and maybe Siberia. And the question is, those look kind of like wave clouds. I wonder if they are. And sure enough, that's exactly what Wolfgang Ringer, the German scientist, found out. And sure enough, they're very analogous to the low-altitude waves that I showed before, right wavelength, right amplitude, and they are distinctly soarable. I should mention at this point that right here is where ozone gets eaten. These clouds can process all the ozone in the polar region very rapidly. It turns out this is a thing called this out here, this yellow stuff, he told me, is a nitric acid trihydrate, which goes through a catalytic process which eats ozone and stays there. And it can just, all the ozone that goes through this cloud comes out no ozone. And this is water ice. It's about minus 86 centigrade. And this is the nitric acid trihydrate, which is about minus 83 centigrade. And it gets that cold because this air has been lifted. Normally it wouldn't be that cold just sitting there, but because it's lifted in the wave, it reaches those temperatures where those chemicals can form and eat the ozone. So the Pearlan Project, as I learned more about this whole thing, I thought, boy, let's do it. And we started the Pearlan Project. And eventually, scouting around for sponsorship, I found Steve Fawcett, the balloonist, and we bought this. I said, let's build a new sailplane and fly to 100,000 feet. And Steve said, well, let's see if this really actually has any merit, if there's any chance of actually doing it. And he said, I'll buy a sailplane, and you go borrow some pressure suits from NASA, and we'll go try it. And I said, sure, lots of fat chance of borrowing pressure suits from NASA. But they loaned them to us, my great astonishment. And there's Steve and I in the glider getting ready to take off. And it worked pretty well. And when you're wave soaring, what we do for these high altitudes, you find yourself, you are always in the desert in the winter trying to do this. And that's the kind of conditions you sometimes run into. But sometimes it's pretty nice. This was in New Zealand. We decided, initially my thought was to go to Sweden, northern Sweden at the Arctic Circle. And then the idea of going to the southern hemisphere where the polar vortex came out further from the pole seemed very attractive because you don't have to be at the Arctic Circle in the winter in the dark. And you can come clear out to 50 degrees latitude where it's a lot of daylight, and it's warmer, and there's, you know, no snow. So that's New Zealand, and it's beautiful. But we tried to make contact with this polar vortex in New Zealand and failed, so we looked again at the map, and here we are. Here's New Zealand, And it's up here around 40 to 45 degrees south latitude. And here's the Andes. New Zealand has some great mountains, the Southern Alps. They go up 12,000 feet, and they're fine. And the Southern Andes are about the same height, but they're further south. We're 50 degrees south, and it makes a difference. And these are straight north-south, which is kind of nice because the winds come across westerly, and they bump right into the mountains. And New Zealand is kind of cocked off at an angle. And also, the winds in the winter typically come around south of Tasmania, and they come up here kind of parallel to the mountains, which isn't so good. In this, New Zealand is excellent in the summer. The winds tend to come around from the northwest, and that works well. But we don't have what we need in the summer. So we're going to go to Patagonia. And there turns out there's an ice airfield right down there at 50 degrees south. And this is the lay of the land. And here's the airfield at El Calafate, Lago Argentino. Mm-hmm. And then here's the Andes. Here's the South Pole down this way and up here toward Bolivia, up that way. And here's some nice mountains at around 9 to 10,000 feet. And they're about 50 miles east of the Andes. So here's an Argentine kind of a Cub equivalent airplane. Here's our glider. Here's the Andes off here. And we take off on this great big runway and fly to the Andes. Here's a picture of the tow pilot took for us. He's up. Here's the Andes. And there's glaciers all over the place, big glaciers here, and icebergs floating down the lake. And it's all very impressive and beautiful. So we send the tow plane home at about 10 or 12,000 feet, and we go on up from there. And you really are a little boat in a big ocean. And here we are going up 1,600 feet a minute up to 36,000 feet, just zooming up, and you really feel that you're in the under the control of massive forces. Although it's perfectly smooth, beautiful, perfectly smooth air, just zooming up past these incredibly impressive clouds, brilliant, incandescent in the sunlight. And then, I stole this picture from New Zealand because it's so pretty. But the views you get are just stunning. It makes the whole project almost worthwhile, even if you never went any higher, just for the scenery. And so here's we've been up high, we're coming back down. Here's our air brakes. Without air brakes, it would take a dangerously long time to get down. There'd be no way to get down in less than several hours. Anyway, they bring us down, and we're happy there. I will say that we went up over 51, almost 51,000, and you look down and you see the airfield. And at that point, you get the real feeling in your heart. Think, boy, we're really high up here. You know, I've been up high in lots of airplanes and with a big motor and so on. You're tending to business and not really enjoying the scenery. Well, you do enjoy the scenery, but it doesn't have the same feeling. You're in a glider, it's silent, and you just bank the airplane and look down. And wow, that's really impressive. And for those that don't know sailplanes are just superbly controllable, marvelous machines. This thing weighs about 1,800 pounds with all our gear in it, and it's carbon fiber. It's extremely strong airplane. It does everything we need it to do. You feel really safe in it. I've flown U-2s at those altitudes, and in a U-2, you like to avoid turbulence if at all possible. And in this thing, you just fly right through it. And this airplane is almost infinitely strong. It's a great machine. So I relate this to the polar vortex. Now, here's the, I'll go back through this a little bit. Here's a subtropical jet stream. And it sits down here 20 to 30 degrees. Once in a while, it wanders clear up to our latitudes here, and they call it the Pineapple Express sometimes. It brings a lot of rain with it. But if you fly to Florida or something frequently, you'll go through it, and you'll get a big tailwind or a headwind and some turbulence, and the captain will talk about the jet stream. It may be that one. And here's the polar jet stream. There's usually two jet streams around. And this one wanders back and forth in latitude. You know, you've seen the weatherman's pictures. It goes all over the place. And this is a week when it's maybe 90 or 100 knots right here. And here's us. This actually was exactly the time and location that we flew our altitude record. And so that's us right there at 51,000 feet on that hour and day. And this data is all from a thing called a global model. And it'd be great if the Commonwealth Club, if the technology people could someday get somebody who does the global model, who really knows it inside out, who could come and really tell you about it. Because everything you know about the weather is in the global model. It's it's your filing system. You put everything you know about the atmosphere in the global model. And it's your bookkeeper, it keeps you honest, and makes all the equations balance. And so with precious little, from here on down, there just is not that much data. But the global model fills in all the blank spaces by balancing the equations. And these turn out to be pretty good. They're not perfect, but they're surprisingly good. So anyway, the necessary condition for the wave to propagate vertically is that the wind does not decrease as you go higher. It looks like it decreased a little bit in here, a few knots, and either it didn't decrease too much or else the global model maybe missed it a little bit and it didn't decrease. But in any case, it was good enough and it took us up here and we were just getting up to the area where if we'd had the right glider built for the extreme altitude, we could have gone zoop right on, continued up. But the idea was proof of concept with that glider. And just more about the concept. Now, this graphic was prepared by the Naval Research Lab at Monterey, and there's a scientist, Navy scientist down there that does this as his day job. And here's sea level and 20,000 meters. That's about 66,000 feet. And here's the Pacific Ocean, the Andes. This is the Andes, and it goes off over to the Atlantic Ocean. And the red is updrafts, and the blue and green is downdrafts. So this is one of the configurations. This is what his computer turns out. And the input, the boundary condition, is from the global model. He just takes the global model, takes an upstream condition, and then he uses the same physical equations that contain all the physics of the atmosphere and runs the global model equations at a high resolution. The global model is fairly low resolution because its globe is big. And this you can make maybe half kilometer resolution. And so this turns out these pictures. And this is the trajectory of the wind, and these are the actual updrafts. So it turns out this green wiggly line is our GPS track projected on an east-west plane. And you can see that his model really did a pretty good job of predicting. This data was 36 hours. It predicted this was predicted for the time we flew based on data 36 hours previously. And so it all worked pretty well. He was certainly delighted to get that feedback. He makes thousands of these graphs and nobody ever tells him whether it bears any relation to reality or not. So this is very valuable to him. And so what do we do? We showed, first of all, that his model is pretty good and that this is just one of an infinite number of possible configurations because they can be all over the place. But if you look at a lot of them, they all have a certain kind of a generic similarity. And so we got up here and we couldn't get any higher and we thought, well, it's time to maybe see if the secondary is working. And so we went back and sure enough, the secondary was working. So So the question was, can we get high enough in the primary that we can get over to the bottom of the secondary and continue up? And we could. So that was good. So we validated the model. We showed that we could jump around in it with a glider. And so Steve and I talked about it at altitude and said, you know, I think we proved the concept. Are you ready, Steve, to put on some money to build the glider to go really high? And he said, yep. And he said, I'm really cold. Let's go home. So that's the glider we started to build. And then Steve died in this crash in the Sierras. And so things kind of came to a halt. And then we eventually got some more influx of money, and we actually started building the glider. This is sort of how you build a new airplane, really from scratch. This airplane had to be built for a pressure cabin, so it has to be a circular shape, and we have to have room for a rebreather system to process the air so you can it doesn't get unbreathable, and so on. So you just start there, and you progress, and a lot of more steps, and you here we are. In an airliner, the air stays nice because you pump a lot of air through from the engines. You press the air, run it through a refrigerator, and pump it into the cabin, and blow it out the back, and you keep fresh air. We can't do that because it takes a lot of energy to compress that air. So we recirculate, and this is adapted from a underwater scuba system. And here's our rebreather guru. And so we adapt it to an oxygen mask and adapt it for the aeronautical use, and that's how we keep the air breathable in the cabin. So that's another effort, and it's been going on for about over 2 years, and it's pretty much ready to go now. And so there's a complete fuselage. This is all very high-strength carbon fiber, and this fuselage was our structural test model. We tested it with lead and... Yes, ma'am. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Maybe if I should go over here. You can see it's really a nifty-looking airplane. We'll eventually paint it white, but this is the black carbon fiber. And it was tested. We put in all the aerodynamic loads to a safety factor of 6, and then the cabin pressure loads to a safety factor of 3 simultaneously, because we're going to be flying at an altitude where any loss of cabin pressure would be almost instantly fatal. So it has to be an exceedingly reliable pressure cabin. The systems have to be very simple and basically failure-proof, so simple that they're failure-proof. This tells you a little about the aerodynamic situation. And here's a Reynolds number, and here's a Mach number. Reynolds number and Mach number determine what shapes will work for a wing, or the whole airplane for that matter. And they dictate what shapes are going to actually be efficient. And you can see that these things go through a very large range. And by the time we get to 100,000 feet, they're very different than they were here. And so you have to have a different shape, or else the airplane won't fly well at all. Interestingly, right about here is the Reynolds number and Mach number situation that it would exist for an airplane flying near the surface of Mars. So there's always talk about, gee, we need an airplane that would fly around on Mars to get around there. And so we're going to build an airplane which, at least aerodynamically, would be well-suited in most respects to flying on Mars. There's some worthwhile scientific research that we should be doing. And here's a couple of the biggies. Stratospheric mixing, how they affect climate models. That was one of the conclusions of this survey report is that that's one of the things they don't have a good handle on. Predicting breaking waves, so we'll get to that in just a second, a breaking wave, but they mix the stratosphere. And those are the biggies that we can have an effect on. I mean, we could actually learn something about that other people don't know. I'll talk about breaking waves here. This is some NASA data from the NASA DC-8 that used to fly out of Moffett Field. And they took it up to Kiruna in northern Sweden in the winter, and they fly along. And here's another case. The wind is coming along this way, and there's some mountains down here that don't show. And this is the actual shape of the wind measured from the airplane. And it shows this a lot of activity down below the airplane and then above the airplane. This thing can look above and below the airplane and see what the wind is doing. And so the wind starts out with fairly low amplitude wave here, and this is about 40,000 feet high. And as you go higher, the amplitude increases. And this trend continues on up maybe to 50 miles. And somewhere between here and 50 miles, this thing is going to get very tall, and it's going to become unstable and break. They call it a breaking wave. And it breaks, and it'll form a big kind of a vortex here, kind of like the old washing machine with the glass door that you watch to go around. They don't make those glass doors anymore. I think they went out when color television came in. It was so. One of the things that the Naval Research Center would like to know is, can I predict where this wave will break? And they don't know. They do predict, but they don't know if they're, once again, if they're predicting it at all accurately. And if they are predicting it, one of the problems with the models is that if you put in all the physics and run it at high resolution, it takes a very big computer. It's a very large computational problem. So you like to eliminate physics that doesn't really contribute to the solution. And so when he has real data, he can start dropping off physical processes like condensation, for instance, or some of the radiation effects, and see, you know, do I still get a solution that makes sense? And can I make a more coarse resolution of my grid and still make sense? So if he has actual data, he can start working to simplify and make his model cheap and practical. So that has a lot of value. And one of the things we really like is the idea to inspire young people to see careers in aviation, science, engineering, and research. And we didn't put on here, maybe more important, exploration and adventure. You know, kids need to know that there's things out there that to be discovered. And why not them? The world, we don't know everything about the world. We got some good cooperative institutions. We got the Louisiana School for Math and Sciences, the high school. These are high school kids. Wake Forest University, Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, and Desert Research Institute, which is in Reno, part of the University of Nevada. Here's some kids in Louisiana, and they're actually, they got a really crackerjack chemistry teacher, and he's helped them set up an experiment to test how ozone degrades the strength of nylon. We have a nylon drogue chute on the back of the airplane. We have to fly up through the ozone layer. And so how fast is our nylon going to get deteriorated so that we have to put in a new drogue chute? So they're actually doing these tests right now. They should be just about finished with the results. I haven't seen the results yet, but they're supposed to be getting back to us with their results. So next steps. So next summer we want to be doing some the basic preliminary flight tests. Then we go over to Nevada, south of Reno, and do fly in the in the waves that exist there, and we want training pilots and system shakedown. So we have a well-established airplane and pilots that are really well-trained in operating it. And then in the August, September, October of 2014, go back to Patagonia and see if we can get up high. Now, we may not get high every year. We looked at climatology, and as best we can tell, there's maybe two or three periods each year of about 2 days when everything lines up where we need it, where the polar vortex wanders over our location, the polar jet stream is in a favorable location under it, and they are kind of uncorrelated, and they've got to get there at the same time, at the right time. And so that typically on a typical year happens two or three times, and there's no guarantee it'll happen at all on a given year, but it probably will. So anyway, that's our plan. Here we are. This is our money situation. So far, we've got about $3.2 million in it. We've built most of the airplane. It still needs to be the final assembly. And we've got to complete the airplane, put in some special mission equipment, and shakedown flights, about another $500,000 will get us back to Patagonia. And there we are coming down from our great height. You know, 90,000 is higher than any power plane has ever sustained in wing-borne flight. People have zoomed through 90,000. The U-2s and SR-71s, they won't stay there. You can't fly along supported by the wing. So we can fly a lot higher than any powered airplane's ever flown. That's what we want to do. This is that drogue chute I talked about, nylon drogue chute. That's our way to get down fast if we get in a hurry to come down. We just come really down fast. So that's the story. So I'm waiting for all kinds of questions to come up. No pressure suits. We're relying on the cabin. Yep. No, it's the pressure that's a problem. Mask will get you down if you come down fast from 50,000. We can get down with this parachute. We can go from 90,000 to 50,000 in about a minute. Yeah, because the high true airspeed you're traveling, you can just push over and go straight down. You get there pretty fast. So we can stand a moderate leak. We can't stand a window blowout or anything. Our windows are polycarbonate, which doesn't shatter. It gets tougher as it gets colder. Say again? It's all made out of prepreg carbon. And prepreg is where the carbon cloth is in a factory. It's impregnated with just the right amount of resin. There's a wet layup where you lay in dry carpet cloth and brush on a bunch of epoxy and then suck out the excess with an airbag system, squeeze it out. And prepreg is a little stronger. You have less epoxy, you have just the right amount of epoxy, and it's cured at a higher temperature. So it's a very strong construction method. And it's all sandwich structure. It has two layers. It has an outer layer of prepreg carbon, a foam plastic, and then an inner layer to give it a rigid structure and also insulating properties, which is nice in the cabin. Yeah, it gives away some performance at low altitude. Low altitude airplanes optimize the boundary layer for the maximum amount of laminar flow that's achievable at low altitude. And for this, you have to give away some of that because at high altitude, it's simply not possible to maintain that degree of laminar flow as far back on the wing. And the wing shape is always developed in a computer program, which it's a great computer program. It's well established, and that's basically where all sailplane airfoils and most modern powerplane airfoils are generated, as on these computer programs. And you give it some basic information on what you want the wing to do, and it gives you the shape, or it tells you you can't do what you want to do. And these are well validated, except we're going a little bit lower in Reynolds number, basically a little higher in altitude than they've really been validated. So we're a little bit trusting that they're going to remain. They've tracked well throughout the range they've been used, and we're pushing them a little bit further. So, yeah. We our speed range is from about 300 to 350 knots true airspeed. You have to fly about 8 times as fast to get the same amount of lift at 90,000 feet. Now, we originally had intended to go to 100,000 feet, but what happens between 90,000 and 100,000 is that you run into a shock wave on the wing. Your Mach, combined with the overspeed on the upper surface of the wing, results in supersonic flow on top of the wing, which is fine, except we're doing it in two things where it's not been done before. One is a laminar wing, which I won't get into too much right now, and the second is a very low Reynolds number, which I won't get into too much right now. But the idea of a shock wave has a, it does separate the flow. A shockwave will separate the flow behind it. Now, normally, when you fly on your 737 to San Diego, the sun isn't the right angle, you can look out and you can see the shadow of the shockwave dancing on the wing. If you look out there, you can see this little thing dancing around, and it does fine. And at those conditions, it reattaches, and it has no appreciable drag. The question is, at our low Reynolds numbers and our laminar wing, will it reattach? And it may or may not. And that part has not been established. So we decided it'd be nice to go to 100,000 feet. That's a nice round number. But 90,000 is a pretty round number, too. And we avoid that problem. And we stick with well-established aerodynamics. But maybe if somebody, you know, if we do that and somebody says, wow, you guys can get up there, somebody might think it's worth their time and money to build another wing which uses the hypothetical airfoils that would work. And we see if they really would, see if they actually would work.
There's no way you can simulate that in a computer program?
No, a computer, you can't simulate it in a computer program. You can simulate a lot, but you don't know if it's really going to happen. Right, yeah. All these computer programs, at some very fundamental level, are tied to empirical data.
Yeah.
At a very basic level, but it's still there. And wind tunnels would have to be specially configured. There are no wind tunnels in the world that are configured for that particular Mach number, Reynolds number, flight regime. And it would cost a lot of money to configure a wind tunnel. You'd pull it out of service, and spend a lot of money to do it, and it hasn't been done. Actually, at NASA in around the late 90s, they put quite a lot of money into building a little glider with one of these special airfoils for the shockwave reattachment to be taken to by a balloon to about 125,000 and dropped, and to actually instrument it and see if it worked. But they eventually ran out of money and decided it was getting too expensive for what they were going to get out of it. So they never went through with the project.
What do you think is the limit?
That's a good question. I've checked that. You got some constraints. One is pretty much you have to agree to make a strong airplane. And it's probably going to be carbon fiber. And it could be a single-seater or a two-seater, But the weight is such that you're going to have around 6 to 7 pounds per square foot of wing area. And that determines how fast you have to fly. And you have to stay subsonic. And assuming you can get this magic airfoil to have low drag with a shockwave on it, then your theoretical maximum altitude is about 105,000 feet. That's where your stall speed and your Mach limit coincide, is about 105,000. So it doesn't leave you any margin for turning or doing whoop-de-doos. So you're probably going to be maybe 100,000 feet. If you could somehow come up with a lighter material that's strong enough, you could get it maybe to 110 or 15,000 feet. But every 18,000 feet, that's the scale height for density. Your density goes in half. So, you know, going more than 10,000 feet higher is a big step. Even 90,000 to 100,000 is a big step. It's bigger than it. Sounds like, well, you know, it's 10%, but it's a big step aerodynamically. So you could maybe try to get 100 to 105,000 if everything was perfect. The winds?
Yeah.
Oh, somewhere between 150 and 250 knots, most likely. They sometimes get up to 300, 350 knots. We should be able to soar with winds on the order of 150 knots and above. That's a good point. Navigating accurately. First of all, you got to fly accurately, and second of all, you got to have a good display. And that's one of the things that limited us was our moving map. Silly problem. But you've got to navigate. You have no idea what you're where you're going over the ground. You have no idea what your ground path is when you're up there. Because if you turn 10 degrees, your ground path can change 80 degrees because you're going not much faster than the wind. So you turn a little bit and the wind suddenly takes you off. So you got to fly very precisely to go where you want to go. I had assumed that the wind would be stronger than our flight speed and that I could just point into wind and adjust speed to maintain position in the wave. And it turns out that our minimum speed was about 120 knots, true airspeed. That was our stall speed. And the wind was about 100 knots. So that was okay. With a moving map, I should be able to navigate. But it turns out when the pressure suit inflated, I couldn't get my arm up above the canopy rail to adjust my moving map so that I could see it the right sun glare angle. It's just a problem you don't think about. And this little computer screen, you got to have the sun angle just right. The sun is absolutely intense at 50,000 feet over an undercast. You got tremendous bright light situation. And so you've got to keep adjusting that. And you don't realize that you're subconsciously always adjusting that so you can see it. And there it was. And my arm was down here. It was up there. Couldn't see it. So the way we worked it out, Steve could move his in the back seat. His seat was different than mine was. And he could reach his and move it. And so I'd say, Steve, mark. He'd mark it on the moving map. And then I'd just kind of keep going somewhere until I was out of the updraft. And then I'd say, well, let's see. I'll kind of do a figure eight or a Whifferdil or some kind of maneuver to reverse course and come back through it. So you take a wild guess at what you think will bring you back through it. And, you know, you have no idea if you're even coming close. And as soon as I turn around, I think, okay, Steve, which way? You say, 90 degrees left. And you fly along. And amazingly enough, we sort of kept biting chunks out of it. And we just bite a little chunk and gain a couple hundred feet and then lose it and do it again and bite another chunk. And so it was extremely inefficient, but it gradually got us up there. If I had been able to see my moving map, we could have been 60,000 feet instead of 50,000 feet. But it just was very tedious. And then the pressure suit had other problems. Steve's billowed out in the front, and so I had to hold the stick back with both hands. And then the legs inflate, which we knew this would happen. And the stick is down between your legs, and so they billows out, and so you've got to compress the big inflated pressure suit to move it laterally. So at some point you start getting things, do I really have as much control as I'd really like to have of this airplane? So, you know, little problems. It turned out to be more difficult than we thought. No. Which one?
The one where you had your GPS map.
No, that was a guy named Jim Doyle. Up until a couple of years ago, he had an interactive, and you could go onto his website, put in latitude, longitude, and he would compute the wave structure for you. And you put in the time, and he would put in the wave structure. And then the Navy got him a better computer, but they wouldn't hire anybody to transfer the program over to the new computer. So that's inactive at the moment. But that's Jim Doyle is his name. Yeah.
Is that a two-place airplane?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a two-place. There's enough work to do for two people in there. There's systems to keep track of. And there's the safety issues, too.
Okay. Heated boots or heated socks?
Yeah, heated boots. Insole liners. That's what we had. That's the only thing we had in the glider. It was like minus 65 centigrade outside. And it was a lot warmer inside, actually. We had the sun coming through the canopy. But there's enough leaks that it's still darn cold. And because of my particular distribution of heights, I sit tall, and I can't sit on a cushion. And when the suit inflates, your head goes up. And so you got a strap to pull it down. But I was concerned that if it went up and I wasn't paying attention, it could push the canopy off, which I didn't want. So I wanted to have a little bit of extra space there, and I flew without a cushion. And the plastic seat is connected directly to the outside of the airplane. And the plastic seat got very cold. And so that got a little painful. And but the boots were essential, and they really helped a lot. And don't take that much power. Yeah, interestingly, in the unpressurized cabin, 35,000 was minus 65, and at 50,000 it was minus 55. It warmed up. We were really in the stratosphere. And two reasons: one, it was a little warmer, and second, the air was a lot thinner at 50, so the convection was a lot less. So you sense the cold a lot less at 50,000 than you did at 35,000. It was actually more comfortable at 50. Oh, yeah, they're building the plane in Bend, Oregon. Yeah. Same people that build the Sparrowhawk and the Duckhawk. Well, they're completely different airplanes. Completely different airplanes. His was unpressurized. Ours is bigger. Ours is an 84-foot wing. That one was a 74-foot wing. They both weigh about the same. Ours is a little bit stronger. Yeah, ours has a circular fuselage. His has a fuselage which is just person-shaped. And ours has special aerodynamics for this low Reynolds number that I mentioned. Yeah. Ours, the sink speed on ours, the efficiency would start dropping rapidly as we reached 60,000 feet. Drag was going to increase a lot, where ours just reaches its best performance at 60,000.
So didn't you measure
Well, yeah, we wanted to make sure that the size of the cabin didn't limit us to certain size pilots. So we got a great big guy, 6'5" tall, to sit in there. He said, you need to make it a little bit longer. So we did. There's not many people that wouldn't fit in there. We don't want to be limited on the people we can recruit for flying the airplane.
Is it easy to recruit pilots?
Oh, it's very easy. Yeah. Obviously, we want really good ones. But we also have availability. You know, we need to be able to, somebody who can make his way to Patagonia and stay there for 3 or 4 weeks. Because we want to have at least 3 pilots on station for about a 3-month period. And so we can get maybe 8 or 10 pilots, something like that, so we can rotate through. And if some years some pilots can't get off work or whatever. And most of the people we end up finding it available, most of them are not as old as I am, but they're old. But we have a few young pilots that are willing to commit to taking the time off. And of course, yeah, that's a good thing. We have a sensor package. One very valuable thing is a thing that all gliders have, and that's a GPS. And so we have very accurate location continuously. We record our airspeed, from which you can deduce your sinking speed. The glider.
You were talking about those other things that there are like 3 or 4 other points that you could mention on the side, which are very interesting, which is sort of unknown. You were talking about wanting kids and having adventure and discovery. There were a couple of things on that slide that are sort of still not really clear what happens if it's sort of mixing and
Okay. Well, one is turbulence. It's pretty obvious. You can look at if you keep a good continuous record of your airspeed. You can see it starts really jumping around. Suddenly you think, this is a breaking wave. And if you record the G-forces on the glider, that'll show that you're in the breaking wave. Yeah, that's in our sensor package. You've got body rates. You've got 3-axis gyros. Yeah, that's all good. And we can measure ozone. We can measure UV. New Zealand has a very big UV survey continuously going, and they like to know where in the atmosphere UV is absorbed. And so if we continuously measure it, they know how much is lost by the time it reaches us. And we can measure UV above and then below, and so we know, tell them about the UV. Oh, yeah. NOAA has a Gulfstream 5 for meteorological research. And they're going to El Calafate. They're going to the same place we are. And their plan is to fly as high as they can go while we're flying above them. And they have some remote sensing they can do from their airplane. And we can say, this is what you think happened. This is what we found actually happened. And so they're very excited about flying cooperatively with us. Yeah.
Mission links set by daylight, always in daylight?
We're always in daylight. They do plan to fly at night, and there'll be some overlap. And eventually we may fly at night if we want to have our confidence well established that we know exactly what we're doing before we start flying at night. But there's no reason we can't fly at night.
Well, thank you, Einar Enevoldsen, for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you.